We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today's encore is actually from 2016 and is an interview with the delightfully zany Zen monks Koshin and Shoto. They're quite silly, as you'll see. We've since interviewed them individually, but this is their classic couple interview. This was also in celebration of Koshin's first book, Awake at the Bedside, and they share why intimacy with others is at the heart of contemplative care. They founded and continue to run the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. For more info on the work they do, check out zencare.org. I want to welcome Koshin and Shoto today. I am so excited to be here in New York interviewing them. So I want to start by getting a little background on each of you so people can get to know you and love you the way that we all do. So Koshin, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, and I want to know how you got into meditation in the first place.
Well, it's so sweet to be with you. And how did I get into meditation in the first place? Well, the story goes that when I was 8 years old, I told my mother I wanted to grow up to be a Zen Buddhist monk.
Was that random? An eight-year-old wants to be a Zen Buddhist monk.
Well, cool. My grandfather used to save all these National Geographics and would look through them with me and just show me the world in a way. And one of them had to do with Tokyo. And so there was this photograph of this monk in Tokyo, and he was totally still. And amidst, in the photograph, all the people in the photograph were blurred. And he was still and had a slight smile. And I remember reading the caption, Zen Buddhist monk.
So you said, I want to be that.
Yeah.
Was your life very hectic at that time so that that stillness appealed to you?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There was just like a lot of family changes and a lot of kind of disruptions. And I was just longing for that quiet. In the midst of everything, you know, to be able to be that still.
So that was your vision. And then when did you first begin?
When I was 17, I used to go to the Syracuse Zen Center where I grew up in upstate New York. And my stepmother at the time was on the board of the local Zen Center.
And Shoto, what about you? I know you have a Very interesting story.
I have a very different story.
Very different story.
So I initially got into meditation through, I guess, my journey of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
I had spent many years as an addict. 5 years into my sobriety, I've been sober, clean and sober now for almost 30 years. But 5 years into my sobriety, I was very, I felt spiritually bereft.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised with no particular faith in England. I was floundering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't quite grasp the concept of this God. You know, I had a very traumatic childhood, to say the least. And so the idea of a God allowing this kind of perpetrations on children, you know, was not in my understanding mm-hmm. of what a loving God is. So in sobriety, I pretty much turned away from the God aspect of the 12 steps. But, you know, I embraced the 12-step program. And then on my journey, I met Dorothy Diane Friedman, who is now 87 and is still my teacher. I met her totally by accident, although there are no accidents, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We got into a conversation on the street, and I kind of blurted out my whole sad sack story. I had heard from a mutual acquaintance that she was a Buddhist monk, and I felt I wanted to introduce myself to her and just be curious about what Buddhism was and meditation. She listened intently for a few minutes, and then she said, "You know what you need to do, Robert?" I said, "What?" She said, "You need to shut up. You need to shut up long enough to listen to your story."
Mm.
And, "Have you tried meditation?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, why don't you come to my Zen center and give it a shot?"
A lot of people say that when they initially learn meditation, they get frustrated because there's so much stuff going on in their mm-hmm. mind. And so I would imagine that was your story
mm-hmm.
because you had so much going on in your mind. And how did you eventually find a calmness in your story?
Who said I have a Who said I have a calmness? I still have a crazy mind.
Tell me about what was your first experience meditating then when you went in. So you go in, you're 5 years into sobriety, you're still in a 12-step program, but you're feeling like you're missing a real spiritual mm-hmm. connection to something.
Mm-hmm. She had said, you know, the first time you sit on the cushion, you're just going to want to run out of the room because pretty much you're crazy.
Because you're, what do you mean you're crazy? Like, does your mind just is like shouting at you?
So to actually sit on a cushion and be still and not run from one place to the next or not thinking about where's my next this, where's my next that. So it was really, really difficult. I mean, I really stuck to it. I really went every morning and sat on the cushion. Even though I wanted to run out of the room and never go back, I knew that this was a path that would lead me towards a saner life.
Many people have said when they begin meditating, what's difficult about it is it's almost like a film of your life. So you see these stories just coming and going. And I would imagine, based on what you just told us, that that was incredibly difficult for you to relive a lot of the trauma of your childhood and your addictions. And
fortunately, I had been in therapy for mm-hmm. quite a while at that point. So there was a lot of distance between myself and the traumas. What the meditation eventually allowed me to do was to not so much relive the trauma, but to bear witness in a mm-hmm. different way to the trauma, to see it and to be able to step back and say, yeah, well, that's not happening now. That was back then.
Is that, would you say, that's at the heart of what meditation is and the gift that it is for people, is being able to sit with and not be attached to that?
I think for me, my practice is about exactly that. The practice did enable me to sit, to allow whatever was arising to arise and to not run away from it. And sometimes it was really painful. Mm-hmm. And today it's different. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that arise today are my impatience, my resentments, my anger, you know. But it's the great tool of being able to just, and now this.
And it doesn't all go away, which mm-hmm. you're so perfect at telling us and reminding us over and mm-hmm. over again mm-hmm. that your anger and frustration and difficulties in relationship and depression mm-hmm. don't go away.
Yeah, for me, the practice is not about trying to get rid of anything. You mentioned depression. I have suffered with depression for many, many years. And now I have a very different relationship to it. It's a friendship almost. Mm. You know, it's medication helps to some extent, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still left with who I am. At the root of it all, who I am is who I need to be friends with.
We interviewed some fifth graders a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying that they had butterflies, but their meditation teacher had said, your butterflies are your friends. Mm-hmm. Just make friends with your butterflies and let that be that. Sharon Salzberg talks about inviting the guest in mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. tea. So I think there are a lot of different ways of thinking mm-hmm. about that. What do you think about that, Koshin?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was when I started meditating, I really thought I really wanted just to be a really nice person. And I thought that meditation would help me to do that.
Were you not a nice person?
I was a nice person, but I was also a lot of things, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. we all are.
Right, exactly.
And I realized that now, 30 years later, what I see is that how people come to our center or come and talk about meditation, and they have that same problem that we want, like this little tiny corner called peace and joy. Mm-hmm. And they come and sit on the cushion, and you see them getting up afterwards and just kind of disgusted. And because they didn't achieve what they thought they were going to get. And so to me, the real gift of meditation is not giving yourself a little tiny corner of the room. I think meditation helps us to, as we stick with it, that gives you more courage to have the capacity to have more friends, you could say, more diversity, more multiplicity in myself, in yourself.
So you guys have such different backgrounds, and even, I've known you for quite some time, and you're very different people. I think we'll
take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Hear that a little bit here, even in this little window into your hearts and souls. How did you two meet?
The short version is we did meet at a Zen center.
But we saw each other across a room at a Zen center 21 years ago.
Didn't actually get to meet each other until 15 years ago.
Right. So were you meditating and you got distracted by each other?
He got distracted by me.
and then he followed me out.
Oh,
and didn't speak to me.
I see. Okay. Very interesting. Let me reiterate the Metro Monk part of the story. So you met at a Zen center. And then how did you evolve
the Zen Center for Contemplative Care. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the work that you do, which is primarily with end-of-life care and training people to be present with end-of-life care. Tell us a little bit about that.
So by the time we had our first date, I was volunteering in hospice, and I wanted to do something with my practice rather than just sitting on a cushion and meditating, and I wanted to be of service. And so I began volunteering in hospice. You know, this, I mean, it was so synchronistic. Koshin's grandmother was dying. He had been taking care of her for 6 years, and during the last phase of her life, they came into the hospice I was volunteering in, and you can tell the story about Mimi.
Yeah, and so she and I made a deal.
Your grandma.
Yeah, my grandma and I, and she lived in Brooklyn. She was a little Hungarian Jewish lady, businesswoman, and very savvy, and was running a law office in the city. And she didn't want to move to an assisted living near her kids, and she really wanted to be close to me. And so we made a deal that I would take care of her and she would take care of me. And she taught me really how what it meant to really care and to commit.
What did it mean to take care of her?
In the beginning, it was just, you know, seeing her regularly and then helping with shopping, going to the doctor, late night ambulance rides, and then hospitalizations. And
what a good grandson you were. Wow.
I was devoted. Beautiful. She taught me about what it meant to be devoted. And so incredible. And so when she moved into the hospice where Chodo was volunteering, you know, I moved into the hospice with her for the last 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And so I was sleeping next to her. Aww. And really some of the times that we spent with her really were so extraordinary. In particular, she really was so struck by how afraid most people are.
To die?
No, to be intimate.
To be intimate, okay.
And she said that nobody really wants to look at me or get close to me.
Because she was dying.
Yeah. So she said, and even the doctors and nurses, they're all well-meaning and good people, but there's not this kind of slowing down. And to talk to me about what's really happening and what's most important. And what she saw with Chodo and I and some of our friends was that this very simple way of just being there. You know, this one night she woke up and woke me up and she was crying and she said, you know, I'm so sorry. And I said, well, what, Grandma, you know, what's going on? And she said, you know, I really didn't know what it meant to love you fully. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, the whole Buddhist thing, the Zen thing kind of scared me. And I realized that a part of me contracted from fully loving you because of it. And I'm so regretful about it. It was so incredible, first of all, what it taught me about loving. And she said, you know, what I've learned now is like to really love someone is to love all the aspects about them, even the parts of them that I don't understand. And then the next day, she told Chodo and I, she said, you guys should start an organization about teaching people how to care. And the Zen thing.
It seems so simple, right? To just sit and be with someone and listen to them. But I think people are so afraid of death and suffering that they want to buy something or they want to, you know, talk really quickly. And I think most people, their intentions are not bad. I don't think they understand how to do this.
But it's not even, it's actually just, it's not just about being afraid of death. It's about being afraid of
intimacy.
Intimacy, relationship in life. You know, look at people today. I mean, we go, you go out to dinner and you'll see a family of four, they'll order the food from the menu and then they're all on their cell phones waiting for the food. And then the food comes and, you know, one of the kids is on the cell phone while they're eating their meal. So it's not that we're afraid of, just afraid of death. We're afraid to be in relationship in life. And this is a really sad statement of our culture today that we've not only become so technological in healthcare, in hospitals, you know, with machinery, people living longer hooked up to machines.
And some of it's amazing.
And some of it's amazing, and some of it's incredible, and some of it is really, you know, horrendous. But we've become the same way in our everyday life. In relationship. Everything's so technologicalized. We actually don't have to interact with anyone.
In the work that you do, you are primarily focused on death and dying. And so you see this as a bigger problem, a bigger challenge for all of us. How do we be more intimate with one another? How do we be in relationship and really listen and hear what someone is saying?
So now the center, we're going into our 10th year. Mm. And so we started out really focused on death and dying. And we still, you know, it's a very important part of our work, but it's really all what we've come to realize. It's about how to engage fully in your life. And we do that through study and through care and sitting.
How does engaging more fully in our lives help us when we're going through a situation that involves end of life?
What we were talking about earlier about meditation, uh-huh. What you learn from a dedicated meditation practice is really how to be with whatever is happening and not move away, to have that kind of courage. So to me, that's exactly the training of how to learn how to be with people in their difficult moments. So if you learn how to be with your difficult moments and not turn away and not blame or, you know, point the finger, but really learn how to be with yourself in a much more intimate way, then you're going to be able to serve people at end of life who are afraid, who are quite vulnerable and exposed. Mm. And it's, to me, the most incredible work you can do.
I agree. I think it's the most important work. And a lot of it is about compassion, self-compassion, mm-hmm. and compassion for others. And we've lost that a little bit in our culture because we move so quickly to what you were saying, Chodo. Mm-hmm. So what's your vision moving forward? What I know you just edited a beautiful book called Awake at the Bedside. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That book came about from this conversation. You know, it's in many ways, it's a national conversation, and we've been holding these symposia every 2 years on contemplative end-of-life care. And the people who are around the center and have been really at the forefront of this work. And so we thought it would be really helpful to create a volume with all their voices. So it's the voices of doctors, of contemplative Buddhist teachers, and poets as well. Mm-hmm. So in talking about their own personal experiences working in this way, really trying to, the way of courage, of kind of, we could say, fearless compassion, and about meeting, not perfectly, but how they meet the moments with patients, with brothers, with their mothers, with everyone in their life. The book is designed as a companion for anyone who's contemplating their own end of life, or the reality is we're all going to meet this in our life. Mm-hmm. So it's really designed to companion anyone who has someone dear to them who is in that stage of life.
So it's not just for people who are taking care of someone who is dying or someone who's actually in the stages themselves. It'll be a great book for all medical schools, all hospitals should have a copy of this book.
Yeah, I hope so, because I really question our medical profession and whether they're learning how to listen and to be with patients in medical school. And mm-hmm. I from my own personal experience, talking to doctors and kind of being rushed through to hearing other people's stories. And so I'm really happy that you guys found examples of doctors who are sitting with patients, spending time with them. If they just have this in their toolbox, they mm-hmm. can be more present for their patients. So you've got meditation and then ethics.
And then really training and listening and giving and receiving. Mm. We call it giving and receiving. So it's really about that receptivity in communication.
Yeah, I think that's...
Those are the three pillars of what we're teaching.
And I hope that we can get this out to every medical school in the country, because I feel like those are such important tools for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing because, you know, we started with the Beyond faculty there, and then now this curriculum is used in 35 medical residencies across the country. So it's the beginning of it.
And you're seeing a lot of the medical students and doctors are receptive. So people are, you're seeing some openness to this now.
Oh, yeah.
And does it matter that you guys come from a Zen tradition, or is that a positive thing? How does that interplay when you've got, these guys are here in their black monk robes. Are they more open to you? Are they less open to you? How does that, does it have any kind of bearing on the presentation or conversation?
I think it really depends on where we're presenting. For the most part, there's obviously, you know, they know who's coming. And a lot of people are curious about Zen, for instance. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that we like to get out of the way when we're presenting to a room full of doctors or students is, we're not here to proselytize.
Right.
It's not about you being Zen students. And what is most important to us is that you, on some level, at some point in your life, can achieve a modicum of contemplative practice for yourself. Because that's where it all starts, this inner journey. Yeah. So, and there are, you know, there are many contemplative traditions, Quakerism and many different schools of Buddhism and Catholicism. You know, they have contemplative practices. Mm-hmm. We just happen to be Zen priests. And, you know, it's a little quirky for some of them. They they see us in our black robes and shaved heads, and they're looking, kung fu. And, and we very quickly are able to open the conversation by being just who we are.
It adds a dimension. But I think what's real about you guys is that you are Zen Metro monks. You live in New York City. You're very... You're just real people with people trust you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is a great, it's a great thing when you're teaching about this tradition. You're not all serious, all Zen, all the time, but you really take these ancient practices and make them deliciously palatable. It's such a gift. It's just great. So thank you for that.
It's a 21st century Dharma, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
For us, it was so important to, because we live in New York City, because we live in this metropolis.
Yeah, the chaos.
In the chaos, that we're living in the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, there are monastics, and they're doing wonderful work, and they're living very different lives in the monastery.
Mm-hmm.
For us, we're about being present in the world, and being present in the only way we know how, which is authentically.
Yeah.
You know, not hiding behind some precious idea of what a
spiritual life
is. Teacher looks like.
Yeah, we're not sitting on a mountain cross-legged. We're living in the subways and in the, you know, in our schools, our relationships. Right.
And we're not saying that everybody needs to be happy and smiley, because they don't. You know, people can be thoroughly miserable.
But in touch with themselves.
And in touch with it. And we move, you know, from being miserable to happy, to sad, to joyous, to, you know.
That's how our lives are.
Moment by moment.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you guys would like to share today?
Awake at the bedside. Contemplative teachings in palliative and end-of-life care is number one on Amazon's Christian Counseling.
Yes.
You guys are such an awesome team. I'm so happy to know you. High five.
Up top, PK.
Love you.
Love you too, PK.
Thank you for coming. Thanks so much for joining us today. Again, for more information on the amazing work these guys do, go to zencare.org. And don't forget to check out Muse at choosemuse.com. Any questions? Email us. Also at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.